Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I mean, I have to say, like, it's so odd to talk about my book at this moment in time. Everything feels like nonsensical and I'm almost like, yeah, it's very hard to just try and say this is work I did. It might be helpful when you think that there's no electricity, there's no medication, there's no bread, people don't have their money. And so what am I talking about really?
This was Nada Mumtaz describing the current circumstances in Lebanon at the moment of the publication of her book, which we'll be discussing in this interview. Professor Nada Mumtaz is assistant professor in the Department for the Study of Religion and in Near and Middle Eastern Civilizations at the University of Toronto. She received her PhD in cultural anthropology from the Graduate Center of the City University of New York.
What exactly is a waqf? How did the waqf become a moral person? Is the waqf a moniker to define objects, or is a waqf a set of practices? These questions have occupied scholars of Islamic law and history, Ottoman and Lebanese state officials, and Lebanese citizens alike. Within certain, and let's say outdated and even Eurocentric studies in the history of capitalism and Islam, waqf practices have often been cited as evidence of Muslim aversion to private property and a lack of progress, as well as the delayed emergence of local capitalism. While the waqf is often simply defined as charitable endowment, the recent monograph, God's Property, Islam, Charity, and the Modern State, pushes against such simple definitions. Instead, God's Property weaves a complex story in which the waqf moves as a practice to become closer to God with pious intent, to a means of evading state control and a mechanism for debtors to protect themselves from merchants, to a way to safeguard a family's future in the form of cash, land, schools, trees, and even personal computers. I'm Jenna.
And I'm Julian.
And we're excited to host Professor Nada Mumtaz to discuss her most recent monograph.
Prof. Mumtaz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and thank you for taking the time to read and engage with the book. I'm very excited for this discussion.
So we usually like to begin the interview by asking how you came to be interested in waqf studies, which I think we can agree constitutes a whole subfield in Islamic legal history and studies within your scholarly journey. Who were the main scholarly influences on your research, especially related to questions of tradition, secularization, via the separation of the economy from religion?
Well, I would say that I never intended to study, waqf. I came in wanting to work on the Islamic revival. It was something that I had encountered quite a bit in Beirut growing up, and it was really like some of these major changes that happened in the 90s throughout the 90s. And so my project was really to study the Islamic revival. I had always an interest in the urban because I trained as an architect, and so I had originally talked about looking at the spatial aspects of the revival, etc. In my beginning of my second year, Saba Mahmoud's book came out, and I read it, and I felt like, well, you know, this says a lot about what I'm interested in, the questions I was interested in. And so in terms of the questions around women, perhaps, and the desire and the different desires, right, people have towards piety. It really opened great avenues, but it also felt like she said, she helped me see a lot of the things I was, and understand a lot of the things I was interested in. And it was during that same class that we also read Brinkley Messick's Cartographic State, and that's where I started to think about Wolf more and more, because I was, it kind of brought together my interests in the urban as well as in the revival. And I would also say that Wolf had been something that existed in, you know, my general perception, or in, you know, in the background of my head, because, you know, there is a Directorate General of Islamic Waqfs, the Awqaf, people talk about Awqaf, so it's something that was familiar. And there's like sometimes banners, you know, or a certain, you know, inviting you to do a sadaqah jariyah, which means a charity that is in perpetuity or continuing charity, which is really a waqf. So it's something that was familiar, but also not really. And I think that's the situation of a lot of people who didn't really, who might know a bit what waqf is, but not really understand its mechanism. So while reading Messick is when I was like, oh, that sounds like a, you know, a good thing to that combines my interests. And I started to see it much more. And so to come back to the question of, say, in the questions of tradition and secularization, I definitely would say that, you know, my approach to how we think of tradition builds a lot on Talal Asad's conceptualization of Islam as a discursive tradition that combines texts and practices. And that is something that is continually changing. It's a living tradition. So that's kind of where my approach to tradition comes from. And that's where I think, to anticipate perhaps some discussions we might have methodologically, it brings together both, you know, documents and ethnography, etc. And I think that's and then the question about secularization. At the time when I was studying, kind of Asad's book had just come out, and that was something that I read with a few of my friends, and that was something that was quite foundational, I would say, in the way we started to think about secularism and secularization. But a lot of the debates around that are around, you know, religion and politics, perhaps. And so the other aspect of my interests lies in political economy. So originally I was really, I came to study at the Graduate Center, particularly to work with David Harvey. And because that was kind of, you know, as an urban, and as a student of architecture, he's somebody who we read a lot. And my work as for my final project was very much built on his work. So that was kind of my other latent interest, my concern quite a bit with the urban process, the accumulation of capital, etc. So I have these kind of two very different interests that come together in the study of Waqf. Given my interest in the economy, I started to also see certain processes of separation between religion and economy. And I think that is something that is rarely discussed, secularization through that angle. And usually it's mostly around the politics and religion. And so so that, I think, is perhaps one of the contributions of the book, to kind of examine secularization through that lens.
Your book is wonderfully ambitious in theoretical terms, engaging many concepts in Middle East studies, Islamic legal studies, and anthropology, including, as you've spoken about, secularism, capitalism, charity, property, family, and the state. I think that historians will find much to work with, since you present a long-durée narrative weaving together the Ottoman mandate and post-independence periods of Lebanon's history. Yet the organization of your book employs a terminology less familiar to historians, and that may be quite original for other disciplines as well. The book has two parts. Part one is called Architecture, and part two is Grammars. What role do these categories play, and how did you arrive at this framework?
Well, I will say that grammar is a term that I do borrow from Wittgenstein via Talal Azad, and it is his invitation to look at the way terms change in meaning, in use, rather than necessarily, for example, just looking at the fact that there are new concepts, you know, that emerge. But even more important is how certain concepts continue to be used but have now different meanings. And so he borrows this from Wittgenstein. But my first encounter with Wittgenstein goes back to a course I took with Beth Bovinelli on language, culture, power, where we read the Brown and the Blue books. And that's where I started to learn about the notion of a language game. And that's kind of where you start learning language through these games. And it is about these different contexts of use that give meaning to words. And so, and I will also say that Wittgenstein and his use in Anthro has a long history, I would say. So Veena Das has an article back in the 1990s, 1998, where she also draws on Wittgenstein and sees parallels between the questions he's interested in and those of anthropologists. So and Das and Azad have connections, you know, they were at Hopkins at the same time. So I don't know how much they, you know, I think each one of them has their own trajectory with Wittgenstein. Azad talks in a portrait recently published about having learned about Wittgenstein in the 1950s. So I feel like there is a kind of a long kind of presence of Wittgenstein, but in anthropology perhaps, and then the term architecture is the term I use. I use it to talk about language games, because I feel like language games is so much tied to language, and so I wanted to talk about this context in which we learn and concepts and what they mean in the context of these life worlds or these, you know, ways of being in the world. And I think for me in this context, it refers to this particular articulation of law and state and religion, even though you can say that, you know, the way religion was understood was, you know, different, etc. But it's hard to talk about these when they are all moving parts. But that's how I try to talk about the architecture, to talk about how there's a certain setting that changes what we mean by law, what we mean by charity, by what we mean by intent, that depends on, or even property, economy, on the particular certain configurations that exist institutionally, but also...
I think the usage of grammar in the text sort of like really pushes like a methodological intervention you're making, which is if we are going to look at someone that we consider a traditionalist or arrive, you know, all like it's more important to look at how people are employing concepts, what are the logics of their argumentation and reasoning rather than using labels as a sort of signification of what they're going to say, or, you know, as a preset notion of what they'll argue. To build off on that last question, the book straddles between what we conventionally separate into history, archival research, Ottoman and mandatory legal case studies, and anthropology, meetings with your interlocutors in Beirut. And indeed, as we will discuss below, you argue that the waqf becomes a person, a moral person, and that's also someone I think that you interview throughout the monograph. But even the monograph's format seems to interject interviews into the Ottoman and mandatory past and vice versa. I was wondering if you see yourself doing both history and anthropology. And if you believe the distinction between the archive and the library can bring the two disciplines together rather than hold them as separate. And this sort of brought to mind Brinkley Messick's idea of the anthropologist as reader as a method for anthropologists.
Yeah, thank you for this question. It also reminds me that it perhaps an important influence on me was, I mean, even though I say that, you know, Wolf and comes from the calligraphic state, but I in some ways feel I am very much an heir to to Messick, and we joke constantly about, I know a lot of his students that even though I'm not his student, I'm the one who works most closely to his method and to the kinds of work that he does, particularly with bringing together, you know, like the deep investigations of the Islamic legal tradition. And so I feel like I do somehow something in between history, Islamic legal studies and anthropology. I feel like I straddle between them because I also look quite closely at Islamic legal texts, whether it is, commentaries and a bit of fatawa, legal opinions, some treatises. And that comes, I think, from my approach to the Islamic tradition as this, as a discursive tradition, and it's a dialogue with some foundational texts, and particularly in Sunni Islam as we see it today, with the fact that there's perhaps no continuing revelation, or very rarely you see that perhaps present, but the foundational texts are quite important, and so I see myself as engaging them as well, because I think they inform practitioners, whether through learning about the Islamic tradition from parents, from scholars whose discourses exist, and so I think especially with regards to Waqf, it's something that there's a lot of feedback loop with these. And so, in part, and given the fact that a tradition changes a lot, and to come to that's why, for example, I'm also do a lot of history, because I think that a way to understand the present, one needs to understand the sedimented kind of past that exists in the practices today. Here, if I want to pick up on your question about Messick's and the idea of the anthropologist as reader, which he discusses in his latest book, he says that he moves between an earlier approach to the study of Islam, say, is more genealogical, to one that is more historical anthropological. So the genealogical one in the calligraphic state, he's interested in kind of a history of the present. How did we arrive to Islam as we see it today? And so what are the, you know, concourse of circumstances? It traces these shifts and these transformations in the tradition. And particularly with modernity. And so that is his earlier work. And then he says that in his new book, Sharia Scripts, he's more interested in what he calls more in the tradition before modernity. So he's interested in a much more historical in investigation of these texts, their forms especially. So I see myself as being interested. My work is very genealogical. So I am particularly interested in the present. I am definitely an anthropologist anchored in the present. But I also have this interest in the past in and of itself, perhaps, because I see it also as an important, not reservoir, but like an important space to think about concepts and how they were existed differently, to kind of unsettle what we take for granted today. And I think that works across audiences. So in some ways it works for Muslim practitioners in Beirut right now, or even activists, etc., who know Waqf in the configuration of Lebanon today, And so I'm interested in unsettling this normalcy of how we see waqf. And I think we'll talk a little bit more about that later, its relation to sectarianism, for example. And I think that is something that is very much particular to our particular historical moment. And it's not something that is, say, attached to waqf. So it is due to the architecture of the state, right? This meaning of waqf and its kind of attachment to sectarianism is something that is due to the particular secular configuration in the architecture of state law and religion in Lebanon, and is not something that has always existed. I'm anchored in the present in a way that an anthropologist is, and so I feel like I have a certain presentism in my historical work that some historians might kind of not be offended by, perhaps, or think that, you know, I am driven by what is happening today to ask questions. And I think, I mean, of course we are all, and I think I'm just much more upfront about it, that I am presentist to a certain degree. And I look at the past as a way to be able to kind of think differently about some conundrums we have in the present. I say that perhaps I'm closer to a conceptual history, of which is definitely a field. but I also, again, because I always put it in conversation with the present, I think I remain an anthropologist, but I feel sometimes I'm none. Like, anthropologists will think it's too history or too Islamic law, and, you know, I feel like that's sometimes the problem of interdisciplinary work that's like truly interdisciplinary, where you wonder where you fit.
Study of religion is
there's that too.
Right.
Well, I think then being sort of betwixt and in between kind of fits nicely into your first chapter's title, which is a non-definition. And so that definitely unsettles any preconceived notions we might have of what waqfs are. And so I was wondering, why do you begin your first chapter with the title a non-definition? And perhaps this is a sneaky way of me asking, what is a waqf, which is one of the hardest to answer. In their book, there seems to be competing answers based on the historical moment. Imam Abu Hanifa's insistence that the ownership of the waqf remains in the founder's hands, to his students who argue to the contrary, that the waqf becomes property of God, to more contemporary designations of waqfs as associations or charitable projects similar to NGOs. And I was wondering if the shifting contours of waqf's definitions can demonstrate the occasional conflict between library and archive, between text and praxis. And I was also wondering if there were any definitions of waqfs that surprised you, both in the historical archive and also in your interviews.
Thank you for this question. It's the genealogy of waqf and non-definition comes from graduate school and from the dissertation writing room. Because, of course, I was constantly confronted with people who, you know, anthropologists who are not familiar with the Middle East and who are like, what is this waqf? And so I was like, okay, I'm going to write a chapter and I'm going to try to explain why it's so hard for me to define it, because it changes, it has so many lives, and I cannot really explain what it is. So that's kind of the genesis of that title, to my exasperation of having to explain, you know, this thing. And of course, for scholars of Islam, it's such a present kind of institution. It's, you know, as I joke, I mean, I have a footnote that says that in fact, in the Encyclopedia of Islam, the entry on waqf is like 50,000 words, written by many people, and it tells you like how complex of an institution that is. But I was wondering if, in answer to your question, I could read something for you and do the reading passage now. Okay, so I was sitting in Hash Tawfiq's office at the Imam Awza'i Islamic Studies College in Tariq Jdide, the Beirut Sunni bastion par excellence. Within a stone's throw were the Beirut Municipal Stadium, home of the Sunni Ansar football team, and the Beirut Arab University. As Issam Al-Houri, the director of the university's board of trustees, had told me a few hours prior, the BAU, the Beirut Arab University, was one of the first private higher education institutions developed shortly after independence with an Arab nationalist agenda to counter the American and French universities founded by missionaries in the 19th century. This meeting was my first encounter with Hesh Tawfiq, but as soon as I entered, and without much by way of niceties and introductions, he started asking me questions about waqf. So what do you know about the difference between an association and a waqf? I was not ready for this question, so I tried to deflect by talking about the 19th century waqfs I had encountered in my historical research in the past year. But he retorted, "These are not waqfs." I was very confused. How could these Ottoman waqfs, which I had assumed were the model for the waqf revival, not be waqfs? And without much explanation or time for me to follow up, he followed closely with another question, with a hint of a smile on the corner of his lips. Do you know the waqf of the Albir wal Ihsan? This was a trick question, because it was the much less familiar name of the waqf behind the Beirut Arab University, as I had just learned from Issam Al-Houri. So my Beiruti credentials confirmed, we launched into a discussion of that waqf. Hesh Tawfiq explained the circumstances of the foundation of the Waqf of Albir wal Ihsan and how he and a few members of the Board of Trustees of the BAU had gone to the Sharia court and founded the Waqf some 25 years after the establishment of the university. Using a grammar of Waqf that I had become familiar with by reading legal texts and tens of Ottoman Waqf deeds, I asked what objects they had made into a Waqf. Was it the university buildings? He laughed at my question and replied enigmatically, "We waqfed words." So this passage to me encapsulates some of the complexities I faced when I was dealing particularly with the contemporary waqf revival. So "we waqfed words" was completely puzzling to me. Like, what do you mean, like, "we waqfed words"? Like, in the Ottoman documents that I had seen, waqfs usually involved an object that has, that can exist eternally and that produces revenues or has a use that's kind of perpetual. So most waqfs that I had encountered were either, say, institutions that whose use can be charitable, so schools or mosques or sabils or, you know, water fountains, etc. And then there was the other aspect of it, which was objects whose revenues supported these very same institutions. So shops and lands and, you know, you name it. So it was very clear that the waqf should be an object. In the Ottoman context, you sometimes also had money. So there was cash waqfs. But in Beirut in particular, I've only encountered one of them, so they were not so present, at least in Beirut at that in the 19th century, even though the idea that they were mostly dominant in Anatolia has been kind of debunked, and there's been studies that have shown that they're actually a bit more widespread even in the Arab lands. And so all of this to say is that waqfs in the Ottoman Beirut that I had encountered were mostly these forms of waqf. And so then the contemporary waqfs look different because a lot of them ended up, what I learned about waqfs as that we waqfed words, Hesh Tawfiq, I think, meant that we just created the waqf as kind of a moral person, as an entity. We didn't waqf any object, we created a waqf. So really, like, what we made was this moral person, or yeah, this legal person. And that is, to me, at the time, was like a huge discovery, that people are really using waqf not necessarily as kind of a funding structure, which is a really important way that it operated, but they actually saw this realm of funding as something separate from the act of charity. Whereas in the Ottoman period, it's through this act of the economic kind of was really the production of revenues was an essential part of what made waqf. It is really a way of financing endowments as much as it is financing certain charitable institutions, as much as it is the financial institutions, the charitable institutions themselves. So, I mean, I think to say listeners who are familiar with the American context, of course, you think about endowed chairs here at the universities and how they kind of have a sum of money that is actually, you know, being worked in the market or however, and the interest is what is used to support the endowed chair. And so this was similar in the sense that there was all of these economic assets and that were kind of put to use, and their revenues were used to support these teaching or imams and khatibs, etc., etc.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So your fourth chapter has a fascinating account of how a group you term Waqf abolitionists use economic arguments to make their case, leading Waqf conservationists to respond in a similar register. And some of this material also appears in a journal article you published in Islamic Law and Society in 2018, which listeners may be familiar with. How does the use of economic arguments in this debate fit into your overall thesis in the book? And what about the other strands of this chapter on family and charity?
Thank you for this question. I would say that you pick on this kind of strand of the argument that I don't highlight so much, perhaps, and because I highlight much more the question of grammar and how meaning changes in context, and I'm looking at these different meanings of charity and family and, you know, intent and Waqf itself, but as a way to look into how do we understand changes of the Islamic tradition in modernity. But this chapter has this other strand, which I develop more, I would say, in the Islamic Law and Society article, where I highlight more that it's not only the grammar, which I do less of in that article, but what I call the styles of reasoning. And to me, that is also something that changes in the Islamic tradition at the time, which is the introduction of what I call the statistical modes of reasoning. So you see in these debates, scholars who are bringing in statistics and economic arguments about the effect of Waqf on the real estate market, on the credit, on all of that stuff, and using them to explain and to justify why Waqf should be or should not be permissible or reprehensible, or, you know, the different values in the Islamic legal tradition. And and of course, that is, that to me is a way that the Islamic tradition in modernity incorporates these new ways of thinking in the tradition, and it transforms, and it's not necessarily a rupture, but it brings in different kinds of reason within still the overarching structure. So it is not that, you know, it's now we are just using interest. Say, for example, Halaq in his book kind of emphasizes more in Islamic legal theories book. At the last chapter, he talks a lot about how interest becomes the driver of change in a lot of places. But what I found here is that that was not necessarily the kind of, it doesn't necessarily become within the scholars that I examine the main criterion for change, but it is incorporated within the structure of, say, analogical reasoning, etc. So these become ways of reasoning that help support or come into these existing kind of structures. So just to come back to your question, so I feel like it's an argument that is parallel to the argument about changes in the tradition and modernity through grammars, and I here present also through styles of reasoning in the tradition. So that's where I see them as separate. And now to come to the question of, you know, charity and family, this is where we start seeing understandings of charity as opposed to profit making. And so I think that's where I was, that's what I introduced just when I was talking about the Waqf and on definition chapter, when I was talking about how religion and economy were not these kind of separate activities necessarily, or didn't feel that they needed to be separated. So what you see is, so, I mean, at the end of the day, to be able to sustain these institutions, you have to have some source of profit. And so they were very much, you know, and it was kind of giving and charity was not defined in opposition to, say, self-interest. So I remember teaching a class one day and the student asked, like, I think very perceptively, like, why is one giving to another have to be purely altruistic? Like, what is the problem of something being both good for me and for that person? Why does it sound sometimes so grating to say that, well, this is not truly altruistic because you're also getting some benefit, say, in the hereafter or, you know, to your family, etc. So I think, and that's something that an anthropologist, Jonathan Perry, talks about in terms of the development of the idea of this kind of pure gift. And he traces it particularly to the development of the idea of, like, the pure market, where everything is driven by self-interest. So you have to have, in kind of opposition to it, this kind of pure gift where it's just about, you know, altruism and, you know, there's no self kind of benefit to that. And so I think that we see similar kind of logics starting to structure the debate, saying that, in fact, all of this money that is benefiting the family is not really, it's about the self. It is not about, you know, it's also hoarded in the private. And so all of these are, they're not really benefiting, like, the public more broadly. So this is where notions of private and public also come in. And I also here build on the work of Ritu Birla, who did great work in South Asia about, you know, trusts and charity and the family business, and how, and so this idea of what like the opposition between charity and profit is something she also she develops really.
So I wanted to ask here about another chapter from the second part of your book. Chapter is titled "The Intent of Charity," and here you describe, among other things, the creditor-debtor relationship in the Ottoman period and the Islamic legal tradition, and the grammar of intent associated with it. And you then describe the changes to the debt regime, the legal regime, and the grammar of intent in the late Ottoman period and moving into the Mandate and post-independence period. So What's your argument in this chapter, and how do you weave together, make this very interesting connection between the issue of intent and credit and debt?
One of the things I forgot perhaps to say is the kind of connection between these kind of, you know, the chapters and how we move basically from the most intimate, from, you know, intent to family to public benefit more broadly. So we're moving in scales, and also in terms of the founder and the beneficiaries, and, you know, so that we're also moving outwards also to the larger, say, public. This is the chapter where I think quite a bit about charitable intent. And interestingly, to come back to that question of the archive and the ethnography and how I'm so anchored in the present, interestingly, it was an encounter in the archive here that made me look at the present differently. So I had not really thought that about intent so much when I was, yes, I did. I knew that for Islamic legal scholars, intent, charitable intent is really essential. And that really what makes a waqf charitable is that it had to have the intent of getting close to God. That's really kind of how it's defined. It has to be a qurba. And so, and I remember asking interlocutors at first, like, how do you understand this qurba purpose? And it just felt always awkward. And I just kind of dropped that question because they would be a bit surprised, like, you know, I mean, I'm Muslim and I'm trying to just be a good Muslim. And so I just felt like I was questioning them. Like, I think what I was doing reflected possibly suspicion of intent, because I was asking them, what is your intent in doing that? And that's something that, you know, is I learned to understand my own assumptions when I was asked, the assumptions I brought with myself when I asked such a question. And so I had dropped it. And then I encountered this file in the archive, in the Ottoman archive, where the mutasarrif, the kind of governor of Mount Lebanon, had asked the office of the Sheikh al-Islam about certain waqf founders who were doing waqf in order to escape foreclosure for debt. And so that was really a first in my encounters in the archive, and I had never seen that before. And so I started to think about, wow, well, intent is something, but how do you ascertain intent? How do you know people, what they're thinking? And then I started to think more about debt and what was happening in Mount Lebanon at the time. Why were there, you know, people who were indebted? Were they rich? Were they poor? Who was really trying to do that? And I will leave you all the details in the book, because it's really like a complicated story. But all of this to say is that both the notables and the peasants who were indebted, so it was also a lot of notables trying to escape the foreclosure of their properties. So it's not necessarily just peasants. So the fact that the question arose, I started to think a little bit more about foreclosure and debt when what was really happening. And of course, there's the whole narrative of, you know, capital and, you know, Mount Lebanon transition to capitalism kind of debate, and all of that silk production in Mount Lebanon, and the way that the economy in Mount Lebanon became kind of connected to these global circuits of finance capital. They were borrowing money from Lyon to kind of create silk that they sold on the market, and how most of the land started to become basically just there to produce this commodity, etc., and how the fate of Mount Lebanon became very much tied to the price of silk on the market, and hence all of the great stories we have from historians of Lebanon, of Mount Lebanon, particularly Akram Khatir, about the migrations and return migrations, and how these, you know, new relations, these new labor relations change gender relations as well, etc. So that's kind of a whole story that exists that I don't dwell so much on. But to me, what was more interesting was the fact that debt was now owed to these merchants who were in Beirut and who were connected to these, you know, credit houses who were in France. And so in some ways, then these credit relations were not just among people who you knew, who you could defer. And it went perhaps against quite a few injunctions of forgiveness in the Islamic legal tradition. And it's important to also know that, you know, a lot of the people doing these waqfs in Mount Lebanon are not Muslim. You know, I mean, they are mostly Christian and Druze, but the legal framework that was used was that Islamic legal framework. And so these same injunctions kind of existed. So even when I looked in the Ottoman Sharia court records in Beirut, and contracts of debt, and actually when there are creditors coming to court to try and enforce, you know, payment, the judges sometimes actually quote the Quranic injunction that says, if, however, the debtor is in straitened conditions, grant him a delay until a time of ease, and it would be for your own good, if you but knew it, to remit the debt entirely by way of charity. So this injunction to forgiveness is something that seems to have structured quite a bit the relations of debt and foreclosures. And even though there definitely existed certain contracts where there was a clause that could be included in the contract of debt that allowed automatic foreclosure, or rather allowed for the debtor to the creditor to go and just to the judge and for the judge to enforce foreclosure. And so while these existed, there also existed the injunction to forgiveness. And it very much structured quite a bit of these attempts to by creditors to enforce collection of debts, and so what happens, of course, is that with the absence of these connections and that tie and the knowledge that ties these communities, these merchants don't care to, you know, to give, you know, to forgive or to give more time to these debtors. And so you have more attempts to enforce these. And I think I need to do a bit more research on that to be able to compare with what Fahad Bshara, he does kind of a similar work throughout the book. So I have a very short chapter, but he actually goes into much more details about whether these foreclosures happen or not. And he actually shows that they do not as much, because they don't care to have, you know, these lands and what to do with them. So it is something that is worth to investigate a bit more. All of this to say is that basically, with the kind of rise in these regimes of foreclosure, I say that it seems that these regimes of foreclosure then render these waqfs much more suspicious, because they are standing in the way of these foreclosures in ways that they were not before, given a regime of forgiveness. And so in some ways, I try to make a link between these changes in particularly economic conditions and even particular dispositions of suspicion towards the intent of founders and their real charitable intent or not, and whether they're really, you know, taking away money from you know, circulation and keeping it in families. And I think that would be one of the connections I'm trying to do in that chapter.
Speaking about placing Islamic studies into conversation with political economy, I think I saw it most prominently in this chapter, and you have this striking line about how sort of the changing debt regimes and the introduction of foreign capital not only changes the means of production and social relations, but also the Islamic tradition itself. And I think that conversation often gets left out. As a follow-up to the question Julian just posed, I wanted to ask a different line about the connection between suspicion and intent. And bringing it closer to our contemporary moment, in one instance in the 1990s debate around Solidaire and other development projects and land expropriation, there was a call for the preservation of wealth by some. Yet the recent graffiti, Tax the Wealth, which emerged in the revolution all over Lebanon, echoes a suspicion towards the council itself. Was the intention of state officials and non-official officials, i.e. community and religious leaders, ever put into question? For example, to what extent were wealth seen as further propelling sectarianization? Are there still conceptions of wealth detached from state bureaucracy?
Thank you for this question, Jenna. So I would start by saying that Solidaire is the name of the company, Société pour Libanaise pour le Développement et la Reconstruction, that was in charge of rebuilding the city center in Beirut in the post 1975-1990 war. And the project was very much based on expropriating everybody, buying people, most people who owned land or people who owned buildings, people who owned shops, who, you know, all the owners and tenants, and giving them shares in the company. And at first they had agreed with the Directorate General of Islamic Waqfs that they would, also the DGIW would give up a lot of its waqfs. And there was a lot of mobilization outside of the DGIW. So in some ways, what's also interesting about that is that these are like state but non-state entities at the same time. So the DGIW, there's a few people in that institution that receive salaries from the state, but a lot of them actually receive salaries from Awqaf, from the Waqf's revenues. So there, and the fact that the Sunni Directorate of Islamic Waqf's is tied to the state is itself an inheritance from the Ottoman period, because most other entities that are responsible for Christian waqfs, which are the churches, they are much more separated from the state. And so the waqfs today, in the way they are understood, are very much considered the property of the community. And that is something, you know, that's how most people understand them. You know, milk al-taifi, it's the property of the community. And part of what I say also is that this connection between Awqaf and the Muslim or the Sunni community is part of the way these communities reproduce themselves as communities, because now you identify with this kind of, you know, you have property that is yours, you know, and so you saw that reproduced in the city center debates. It's about also the presence of the Sunni community in the city center. You know, in many facets, the articulation of waqf as property of the community, which is part of the interventions of the French mandate, that's how they defined waqf, has helped make waqf a space through which sectarian identities are reproduced, which is what, for example, also Max Weiss argues in his book, you know, when looking at cemeteries, etc. But I do think that there's a more complex story to that. And that's what I tried to highlight in the story of the community and opponents to the Mufti and, you know, various you know, Muslim Beirutis Sinnis who are just kind of appalled at the fact that the DJIW sold, quote unquote, the wealth of the community. So in some ways here, you know, what's happening is that there is a sectarian kind of coming together of the political leaders and the religious leaders, because of course it is Hariri in conjunction with the person who was acting Mufti at the time. And so the elites are kind of coming together, but there's also opposition at the grassroots level against that. So it's not necessarily, and using an Islamic legal idiom, so it is not necessarily one that is a sectarian one. So they are, it's, you see divisions within the sect itself against the way the sectarian leaders are acting. So I think that there's more complexity there than just saying, yeah, it just reproduces sectarianism. And I think part of what it does is, you know, there is an aspect to these awqaf that are not just about our presence as Sunnis or the Sunnis and what's happening to them. It is also about, you know, these family waqfs. There's also these, you know, wishes of dead grandparents, or, you know, all of these other arguments that come into the picture about why these waqfs and their perpetuation matters. And some of that language is drawn by scholars from the Islamic legal tradition, even though they don't exist in law right now, and, you know, people can just very easily sell awqaf, or, you know, exchange them is the official term, but they really can be sold very, not very easily, but to a certain degree, it's possible. And so I would say that in the general, like even, you know, the tax, the waqfs that was spray painted in the city, in the during the revolution in on the Al-Amin Mosque and on the St. George Church, I think it is very much an incrimination of these institutions and these waqfs as part of the sectarian elite. And I think there definitely is something to that, but I think there's also a more complex story that we need to look at, and that there are also ways to use waqf in ways that are not necessarily doing that work, that sectarian work, let's say.
Thank you so much, Professor Mumtaz. Perhaps we should close this interview by saying, first of all, congratulations on the publication of the book. It just came out this week. Second, as dictated by New Books Network conventions and academic tradition, we were just wondering if we could ask you what you're currently working on. What's your next project?
Thank you so much for having me and for these great questions. So regarding my projects and what I'm working on right now, one of the things is the question of Solidaire that you guys brought up. And because Solidaire, it's such a kind of touchstone for not just Lebanon, but also more broadly. So right now with the reconstruction post-blast, it's really come back as the model against which everything is compared. And the kind of not to do, given that it is really rebuilt and it's, some of it is beautiful, but it's really empty, and it's really mostly a speculation ground. And so I was interested in doing a bit more research on Solidaire itself and on the waqfs there, and to also look a bit more at the reason why certain, you know, there was a lot of organizing against the plans of Solidaire and against expropriation, and rights holders came together, and, you know, there was an association that was made, lawsuits were filed. It was a big kind of opposition, but that was kind of very much cut. And it was very much using, you know, rights to the city. It was using, you know, the regular legal tools available about how does expropriation happen? Is it really based on public benefit? Is that public benefit, etc.? And so why did these kinds of mobilization fail? And whereas a mobilization around Aukaf work, I mean, there are certain hints. Of course, Aukaf are much more less numerous. So whereas if you question the whole premise by questioning the expropriations, the whole project will fail because the is based on buying out everybody, doing some improvements that the state pays for, and then you reap the benefits by selling them at a much more expensive prices. And so there is that reason, but I do think there's also some more complex story to be told about the appeal of these quote-unquote sectarian arguments and or religious arguments, however you want to frame it. And I wouldn't, that's why I say quote-unquote, because I think there's more to it than the sectarianism. And then another project that is more kind of preliminary is one that builds on this question of charity for the family and filial piety. And I'm interested in perhaps a more ethnographic research that, I mean, it might have a bit more historical as well, but it talks about elderly care. And so how children, the injunction for children to take care of their parents, especially in old age. And so how does that happen? What forms of living situations exist? Who does the labor for care? And how does this change with the presence of certain institutions? And I think it brings in also particular questions of labor, because a lot of work is done by domestic workers who are immigrant, and so I think it brings in a bunch of questions I'm interested in, the particular economic, the religious tradition, and also the architectural, perhaps, because when you think about homes and how people live in certain homes, and also the building of senior homes as a typology. So I think it brings in all of these different interests I have. And I think it's a huge question right now, because when I was in Beirut this summer, it was really very, very, very depressing and hard. And seeing a lot of senior citizens sleeping on the streets, which is because of the blast, because of housing, because of, the financial situation. I mean, it's a project I've been thinking about for a few years, but I think seeing the situation in the last few months, at least, was a reminder of, the presence of such questions.